Welcome to Ellie's Coffee Talks, the podcast featuring creative entrepreneurs in the Basel area over the best cups of coffee in the best cafes. Bonjour Ben, Benjamin.
Hello.
Je sais. Ah oui, bizarre.
Are we doing it in
second try? Good morning, Benjamin Delahaye.
Good morning, Ophélie Cabanero.
And that's exactly why I don't say family.
How are you today?
Yeah, I'm great. It's a day off. Well, kind of.
Kind of a day off.
Yeah.
We're hustling with this podcast.
Yes.
It's good.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. So, okay, a little bit of an insight. She asked me the same question a minute ago,
yeah.
And I said, not so good.
Depends.
Depends. Shall we get into it straight
yes,
away?
Yes,
okay. I mean, I'm okay. We're living through crazy times, and
You're really feeling it.
I am really feeling it. I have a double life. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have, during the day, I work for a travel company, and as you can imagine, it's travel education. So people travel abroad to learn a language, and that's completely disappeared. Since January.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't had any customer, and it doesn't seem like we're going to have summer language trips.
Mm-hmm.
And most likely, even so, we're hoping to start again in September, but people will be nervous, right? So they won't be so keen to travel so much, and there will be distancing rules in schools. So the past few months, I've seen my professional life kind of shrink. lots of people have been on temporary unemployment or actually have been made redundant, and it's been kind of a sad, sight. It's a great way to start the podcast. And then my second life is I'm a comedian. But that's also been a bit sad because we haven't had any live shows shows with an audience since March.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember I had a show at this theater in Zurich called Comedy House where I do my monthly show. And I opened with like 10 minutes of jokes on Corona, and I came on stage with a Corona bottle. And I feel so stupid today. You know?
You were making fun of it.
Yeah, I was like, no, I wasn't making... Actually, I wasn't making fun of... I wasn't making fun of the reaction. And because I've always thought it was serious. So more, I was trying to... You know, I was trying to even vent my own stress with these jokes. But I still... You know, so especially it was in February, so there was still a lot of unclarity. Mm-hmm. What is this? What is the? What should we do? How does it evolve? What does how can we protect ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
And the only it's like wash your hand with soap,
mm-hmm.
and it's it's really, and so. So, you know, like stuff like that, or, you know, the headlines or you know, the conspiracy theories around it, like because already people were doing conspiracy theories in February about it. So
did you watch them?
Oh, I love conspiracy theories. I don't believe in them, but I love watching them. It's like some people watch Netflix series and I spend times just looking at conspiracy websites. So it's like because there are their own stories.
Yeah.
You know, so...
So it doesn't freak you out. You don't believe in it at all.
Not really.
Or you see it as another kind of news channel, news platform, another perspective.
No, I don't see it as... Well, it's definitely another perspective, but I don't see it as a valid perspective. I see it as a regression of intelligence in our society. But here's the thing. So my grandparents used to be conspiracy theorists.
No.
Yes. So, but about everything. But in their times, there was no internet, right? It was a very limited circle. And they would always come up with the craziest theory. you know, like, okay, what's...
Were they French?
Yeah, they were French. There was this one day, this journalist who died on his bicycle or something. French journalist. I can't remember his name. Something Allier or... You're too young anyway. By the way, this is a podcast with an old guy. I'm 41. I'm 41 tomorrow.
Oh.
No, Saturday. Anyway.
Birthday podcast.
Birthday podcast. Hey, fans of Ophélie, you know, if you want to wish me a happy birthday. So,
as if it's going to be released until then.
What, you don't release the next day? Oh, gosh darn it.
Okay.
Can we swear on your podcast?
Yeah, sure.
Good. So I don't have to be like goody two shoe, like gosh darn it. Oh shoot.
You can even speak French if you want.
Oh well, that's the ultimate swear.
Putain,
merde.
I was gonna sleep.
So what were you saying? Yes, conspiracy theories. Like, so this journalist died on his bicycle, and immediately the same day they're like, no, but he was shot. I was like, where do you come up with all this stuff? And they always knew. They knew,
yeah.
You know, there was a lot of things that they didn't tell us. and I guess like they would meet with other conspiracy theorists, I don't know, on the weekend or something, but it was very like limited. So that's why, you know, like, so for me, it's also been part of my life.
Yeah. And grew up with this.
Yeah. I grew up with this, or always, you know, always going against the main narrative in a, like, which I think is sometimes it's good, you know, like, because there's definitely like main narrative in our society, and it's good to have some freedom from mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't know to which extent. So
basically,
oh my god, there's, okay, so I have crazy stories. There are also, so there are two things that they feared. So they knew, okay, that there were things they didn't tell us, and anybody who died was always a murderer. So that was the first thing. And they're also afraid of communists. So it was their main fear in life. When Mitterrand was elected in 81, so it was like the first socialist president in a long time in France, they bought property in Latin America. Because they thought that the chars, no, how do you say les chars?
The military
chars, the panzers.
Yeah.
You know. Well, you have to be international.
Exactly. <It's okay. laughs>
So that the Russian panzers would roll into Paris. Just because we had elected a socialist president.
Okay.
Yeah. Not really thinking that they would have, those panzers would have to go through many countries before coming to France, that many other countries could have been like, hey, sorry, can you please not go through us? And they thought, you know, so they always had this crazy...
So they were capitalists, or what was their political...
They were... Yeah, they were mostly on the like right wing when it comes to economy. Mm.
Mine too.
I don't know that they were completely capitalist, like we would say today.
I can't believe we're talking about politics.
That's
this
okay.
Definitely never happened.
This podcast is going to be.
It's going to be smarter.
It's going to be, of course, because there's two French people on it.
Oh my god! keep listening, please. It's going to get better. This is about creativity, and I
yes. Oh yes, yes. This is going to be a podcast about creativity.
Okay, so you grew up with crazy ideas from your grandparents.
I grew up with crazy family because so every dinner on Sunday would be like you know, for example, when we have the presidential elections, there's like a debate in the studio after that, and there's people from every party that are screaming at each other and disagreeing.
Yeah.
No, you're like... I like politics
like
as well.
TV?
Yeah,
on
TV, yeah, sorry.
I don't know anything.
You know, TV is like this thing for the... for the boomers. I'm not a boomer, by the way, okay?
What are you,
at least Generation X, I think. Between X and Millennial. I mean, between. I'm an in-betweener. So I don't fit in. See, this is going to be a great podcast. I don't fit in a box. I don't fit in any of the generations. I feel I'm special.
Yeah. And you are.
Thank you, Philippe.
I'm just a millennial, but we're all special, all millennials.
Yes, special. You're all special, all of you. So if you are interested in politics, so every time there's an election, the TV studios invite people from different parties to comment the result, and usually they insult each other. And that's what was my family lunches every Sunday. So I had a socialist uncle, I had a communist uncle, I had, so my grandparents, when I say they were right-wing, actually they were actually a bit more right than...
Very right, than just, huh?
Yeah, yeah, kind of very right. But you know, like, old friends...
It was normal, yeah.
Old friends, okay?
My dad calls me the Bobo Gauchist.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
It's like the hipster left, I don't know.
Yeah, left-wing hipster.
Yeah. Mm.
So yeah, but I guess, like, so I guess maybe that's how I always got this, and my parents were more right-wing, but more, you know, economical right-wing. And that's kind of where I got this idea that any idea goes, you know. So I'm not really attached to a perception of the world or the right economical solution or the right way to lead the country or whatever. Because I was raised with all these viewpoints, which in their own world, they all had a justification for what they were saying, you know? So if you have a bit of empathy or you put them in their shoes, you're like, okay, I can see how you see the world like that.
That was a great...
conspiracy theories.
That was a great transition.
But conspiracy theories... So since this is about creativity, so we're going to make this about creativity,
yeah,
I promise.
At some point, yeah.
But conspiracy theories is definitely creativity in action. It's like a common produce creativity, you know, because it's like a story that they are all building together. And, you know, okay, if we look at today, so now the new target is Bill Gates, you know, so it's Bill Gates who made everything. He made the virus. So that Trump wouldn't get reelected. That I love. The conspiracy theorists from America think that it's mostly something from the Democrats. So that he wouldn't get reelected you really don't want to talk about politics.
No, I watch also conspiracy theories, and yeah. I like to have different perspective to not get, well, first of all, too freaked out about this virus, you know, yeah. Because if you watch the normal news, as I call them, there's only this, you know.
And
when I call my grandparents who are still alive in the south, they don't go out of their house. They only have TV. They don't have a computer. You know, they only play board games or card games and watch TV. Yeah. And all they see is "be careful, be careful, be careful." They are losing it. My grandma is so scared. Of course, they're old, and you know who knows. And they have such a shitty life, you know, they don't go out, maybe it's the last years, who knows, you know, so they should watch conspiracy theories, actually. Don't worry.
Yes,
I should replace all the news, put cassettes in the TV thing, but I like to have different perspectives, for sure, and then spiritual practices. You know, to balance it out. Like,
it's
meditation.
So funny that so like recipe for peace, spiritual practices, and conspiracy theories.
Because at the beginning of this period, I was watching so many news and conspiracy theories. I had to do 2 hours of meditation a day to balance it out.
Wow!
This will be a joke on stage at some point, but
please.
It was true. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not for this purpose. It was just how it happened.
Yeah.
And meditation definitely helps. Okay. Yes, I think I would have lost it otherwise. But also, my life was pretty normal. Didn't change much. So
it's funny that because I don't have the reflex to do meditation. So I like meditation. I can't do it 2 hours. But I noticed that when I do it, even just 10, 15 minutes a day,
it changes.
It changes everything. Mm-hmm. But then in times of stress, I forget.
Yeah.
And it's actually listening to you, I just realized, oh, I should have done this.
Yes.
The past 3 months, because yeah. I've been slipping away slowly into the realms of like insanity.
Yeah.
So.
But then you used humor to not slip into madness, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is also, I just released a blog post on Monday about how you can, what is humor exactly? Oh, I mean, exactly. It's just a definition my partner came up with.
Yeah.
But it's so much more than just a joke.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, humor for me has been, I would say, I don't know, kind of life-saving since, from a very young age.
Oh, yeah.
Because today I joke, I say how, we had all these different perspectives in our family and but my family was crazy.
Hmm.
Okay. So I've grown up in this environment that was very stressful for any kid. And all of a sudden, I found these professional comedians that, these are people who get, they're a professional of making people laugh. Mm-hmm. And they made me laugh a lot, So I found a lot of comfort.
When you were a kid already.
Yeah, as a kid. Not in making other people laugh, but I found a lot of comfort listening to comedians and finding a break in my life from this craziness. So at first it was kind of like just a distraction okay, there's a reality that's not so fun, and then I can just escape from it a little bit with the, with his laughter. But then as I got more and more into it and listened to really good comedians do you know Pierre Desproges?
No.
Okay, so. But he's even not my generation. But so I like to go back to what was, done before, or to the classics. Once I got into it, I got into the plays of Molière, and
I know
that. And it's I would hope so. at least at school. and then I realized kind of what you said in your blog post. I mean, not what you said in your post, but more like it's got a much deeper function in society than just offering a temporary distraction.
Yeah.
Like it's something that is really deep, and then there are some problems that they are so, the pain of it is not solvable. Therefore, the only one of the only options you have is to laugh about it.
Mm.
That's the, because Or feel sorry for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So.
And my partner always says, the Joker in the Middle Age or.
Yes.
He was the only one who could speak about certain topics.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you would get killed.
Yeah.
So it's still a little bit like this, I think, for comedians.
I have a precise example, so but my wife is Ukrainian. Mm-hmm. And so I also I spend some time with the Russian speaking community.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that in Russia the comedians are the only ones who can openly criticize Putin, and he allows comedians in his vicinity at dinners to make fun of him. Mm-hmm. And it's the function of the Joker.
Yeah.
Because it's exactly the same. It's like you can the comedian has this status where they can say things to people who are in power that nobody else dares to.
Yeah.
Because it would have horrible consequences for them.
Exactly.
But in a way, I mean, it's a privilege, but also the price to pay is also, for example, in the case of Molière, like even, okay, he had some support from the king in a way. That's why he was able to do everything that he, to say all the things that he said. Mm-hmm. But then when, you know, when he died, they just, you know, threw his body. Mm-hmm. Like, it was only a long time after that he was recognized mm-hmm. as this genius. And, mm-hmm. But he definitely paid the price in his, you know, in societal treatment. Like, you get a privilege to say what you want, but at the same time, you don't get, like, the rewards, mm-hmm. in a way, in history. I think mm-hmm. today is a bit different. Mm-hmm. Now, like, I think today, if you see comedians, like, I think Jerry Seinfeld was the first comedian that inspired a lot of people to go into comedy. I was like, oh, I can be a comedian and be really successful.
Because he was just not acting, or why? Because a lot of comedians quote him, and I don't watch him actually, but because he was one of the first ones who was just talking and standing.
No, he's been. No, there was a lot of comedy already, stand up comedy before him. In America, so he wasn't the first one, but he had a very successful show in the 90s
on TV.
And Seinfeld, the show Seinfeld, is kind of the embodiment of the 90s in a way. Mm-hmm. and especially, okay, 90s in New York. Mm-hmm. You know, like, kind of like the single life, going out, etc. and that show was so good, and it was really like a, I mean, for the US, it was like a culturally defining show, mm-hmm. but even had ripple effects in, you know, outside of the US. I mean, I was watching it when I was 13, mm-hmm. and this is kind of how I got into, this is how I got into English. So I learned English first watching sitcoms. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got really into it. You know, not from the lessons that we would get in our French schools,
course,
as you know.
Course,
so.
But so, why is he famous as a stand-up comedian?
He was already, so before that, he was already a successful comedian. He was working a lot as a comedian. He was filling theaters. I guess he was very clean. So all the club comedians tend to swear, talk about their genitals or stuff like that, and he would always be super clean. I'm not sure what made him popular at the time, but then I guess he was really smart, and they just gave him a show, mm-hmm. which didn't work for 3 years.
Never gave up.
And it was, I guess it was the time where they were like, okay, they still gave him a chance.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
I think it was a case where the show didn't work, but they did, NBC didn't want to lose him to another network, so they're just like, okay, we'll keep paying. And
the good times.
And then eventually it exploded. Mm.
So you were watching him when you were a teenager?
So Seinfeld I was watching, but okay, I dragged my mom to see a theater comedy show when I was 10. So we went together. It was Les Inconnus. You know them or not?
Yeah.
Okay. So they had a show in Paris, and I brought a tape recorder, which I hid in my coat. And I it was mini cassettes like this.
Yeah.
And I put it in, so it was winter, so I had a coat. Okay, so I put it in the coat and I recorded the whole show. And then I think, I don't know for how long, at least 1 year, maybe two, I would play the tape under my pillow every night before going to sleep.
Wow.
So I listened to that show. Yeah, I don't know.
You know it by heart.
600 times. Yeah. Okay, now I would... Actually, if you ask me now, I don't...
Yeah.
I wouldn't know how to... But if I would start hearing the skit, like, I would know exactly, you know, which word comes next, what, you know, what the rhythm of every joke, the phrasing, the everything, the melody of the comedy.
I'm looking on YouTube if I can find that, but...
And the show was amazing. Called Au secours, tout va mieux. Okay. Help, everything's getting better.
That's good. And you understood everything they were saying as a kid?
No, I don't think so, no. But they still had skits like, you know, they would teach French Revolution to the kids, and that I could relate because I also was studying the French Revolution at school. Yeah. Or they were parodying Chantal Goya, and they had, you know, Chantal Goya was this singer for kids. Yeah, exactly.
she had a
frange.
and dresses.
And she used to always come on stage with these stuffed animals, you know. Yeah, so I have songs with animals. Casimir. And so they would Casimir. I don't know if it was Casimir, but he was always this like this lion or this wolf or so she had a song about animals. And so they were parodying her. And one was like a fly that, you know, those flies that eat shit. and so that I could understand, you know, that was easy.
Do you remember Les Grévistes?
Yes. It was. So this is how the show would start. So the show. So they would come from, the back of the theater, with, you know, with signs saying we are on strike. We refused to do the show, and so before the lights went down, so like everybody was sat down, we didn't know the show, and then we just hear this commotion in the back, and the three of them just come and say, you know, we're canceling the show, we're going on strike. So that was
So you believed it, you thought, oh, maybe it's true, or
because you see straight away that it's them. Yes. Oh my god, that song. So this is how the show started.
Childhood.
So I'm getting goosebumps. Look.
He is.
So I'm getting goosebumps. So can you imagine? I've listened to that show so many times.
On the tape.
On the tape.
Day.
So this is kind of how I got...
It's a background song. It's great.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's see if you can remember.
Okay. I'm trying to say when is the next punchline. Hey. Avec la CGT. Okay.
Amazing.
La CGT. Yeah, they look so young here.
Yeah.
On le spectacle ce soir, on est ici pour les revendications de nous à la CGT, monsieur.
Solidarité avec la CGT.
C'est pas la peine d'essayer de lire si c'est écrit sur les tracts, t'en as rien écrit, étant donné qu'au moment de les imprimer, les camarades...
Ah, les camarades étaient en grève.
T'es toujours en grève, hein, messieurs-là. Nous, à la CGT, nous estimons pas satisfaits. Donc, que nous n'obtiendrons pas...
Satisfaction.
Pardon, monsieur, t'as le texte, Maurice?
Non, mais 15 ans de CGT, je connais.
Parce que nous, à la CGT, sommes résolus de mener notre action à bien, et nous ne céderons pas...
So as you can imagine, as a 10-year-old, the CGT skit is maybe not the one that resonated the most. Especially with my capitalist parents.
Yeah. And grandparents. Yeah.
But it's definitely, I mean, I became funnier after that. Like, so...
So from you know, this
so from there, from this experience, listening, you know, like with my friends, I would start to know like what would be the right, the funny thing to say in that moment, or, and I guess like most comedians, they listen to a lot of comedy, you know, in their childhood or later. Most comedians are comedy fans.
I heard that a lot of comedians wanted to be funny for their mom or dad, you know, because sometimes they were depressed. I have two examples of comedians like this, and then they were trying really hard to be funny, you know, to uplift the family.
So I was part of my Sunday lunches, I was putting on shows. You know, so I wanted to do a show on the Sunday for lunch for the family.
So you were acting.
Yeah, so me, and I would enroll my brothers and sisters in it. So we had this big production, and I was trying to, and I was the only one taking it seriously. So I would just spend, you know, my time yelling at my sister for not following the instructions and stuff, and my parents didn't give a shit.
Yeah,
so they were never listening. You know, so then I just remember it was not fun at all. Because, like, it will go completely not according to plan. And then, because also, you know...
Your plan.
There's a bit of trying to control your reality a bit when you go on stage. And, you know, it's all of a sudden, everybody shuts up and listens to you.
Yeah.
And you've already planned everything that you're going to say. And so...
And I'd love to come back to that
later. Yeah. And so... That plus, you know, and then looking at my parents and say, listen, I'm doing the show.
Were they watching the news also at the same time, or the debate?
No, they were not watching. I don't know what they were doing. It's vague memories. I think they just didn't really, they were not that interested.
Do you remember what you were playing with your sister?
We were playing, so we were dressing up. I have one memory where I took some of my stepmother's clothes and I would put two tennis balls to make boobs. And I would just play this woman. That's all I remember. I feel this podcast has the potential to be like a psychological deep dive
totally
into everything,
and you can use it for your autobiography at some point.
Yes, I remember when Ophelia Cabanero interviewed me, it's when I realized a lot of things about myself. This is when my life changed,
and I became a full-time comedian.
two days before my birthday, yeah. I had this revelation. I'm 40 for two more days, then I'm 41.
You're freaking out.
No, I freaked out last year.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay.
Enough.
No, there's not much you can do.
Do you want to share what you freaked out about? Because I freak out on my birthday because I'm thinking I should get my shit together.
Oh, yeah.
What do you freak out about?
Yeah, getting my shit together. I mean, I'm a champion in comparing myself to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I take what is best about everybody
yes.
and put it into like one ideal image of who I should be.
And what is that?
But it's everything. It's very ego-based. Like, I should be...
Rich or...
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
I should be a very rich entrepreneur, but also should also be a comedian.
So entrepreneur in what?
I don't know. I just know I should...
Not in comedy.
I don't know.
Also, you live in Zurich. It's not helping, huh?
No.
In the wanting these things.
Yeah. I fell into the Zurich trap.
Yeah.
I've been here 10 years.
Mm.
And I spent so much money my first 5-6 years. Because, you know, so you go out and you pay for restaurants. Or you know, you think you have to live the high life.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then I took a humility lesson. That's better.
Yeah.
So
entrepreneur.
Yeah, I mean like a media entrepreneur, I should, you know, by now I should have a YouTube channel with 50,000 followers. Yeah. So and same on my Instagram. And,
yeah.
And I should have a touring show.
yeah. Is that what you want? Tour in Switzerland or the world or France?
Yeah, I'd love to be a touring, because I travel a lot for my current job, my day job. And so, like, I'm used to be on the road. And my family is used to me being on the road, which is good.
Mm.
So if I ever become a comedian, it won't be like a change.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't mind the travel. I like and I like the stage. You know, I've tried many things. I've tried writing novels,
okay.
Plays. You know, produce videos. And there's something about the stage that has an immediacy to it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, you try something, and especially now with this community of comedy that is in Switzerland, you know, the English speaking
mm-hmm.
comedy community. I mean, you can try something the next day, like
mm-hmm.
And I still don't do as many shows as people like Vanessa and Bilge, but I still do, you know, 4 shows a week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
you work
for... No, 4 shows. No, sorry, not every week. Sorry. So there are some weeks I do 4 shows, but I looked at no, it's not 4 shows a week. But I, on average, last year I did 10 shows a month, which you know.
It's a lot when you have a full-time job, no?
I think yeah, exactly. And so it's a little bit. But I love it, you know.
It gives you energy to
be on
stage.
Yeah, it gives me energy, and I like this writing. I like this process better than so. Just before comedy, actually, so I was trying to write novels.
Mm-hmm.
So first, I try a novel, and I could never be satisfied with what it's about, you know. So I wrote so many thousands of words, and everything just went to the trash.
But did you read the War of Art?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's what he talks about, no?
Yeah, but even that didn't help me.
Okay.
So, I tried reading those, you know, books like this, or Bird by Bird, or that's also another good book. And then maybe it was the tool. Maybe I need another writing software.
Definitely.
Definitely. You know, so like that was like a year and a half. And then I wrote like a children's story. And it was the first time when I finished the first draft, I was like, hey, you know what? Actually, I like that. So then I worked on it to make it, so it's, I made it much shorter and kind of different. It was another 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put it out on Amazon Print On Demand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I'm really proud of this story, but it was like, fuck, it was just so long.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, I don't enjoy the solitude of writing novels or even short stories, or you know, even for kids, because there's you're on your own for such a long time until you can get some audience feedback.
Yeah.
And even they don't really tell you, because you know they're reading it, and if they're your friends, they're gonna say something nice, and you know, so it's kind of hard to get,
but you need the feedback.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I need the feedback. I'm an extrovert. I live through other people. I don't. And so that's why comedy is really perfect for me, because
direct feedback.
It's direct feedback, and sometimes it's even in open mics you test a half-assed idea, like it's not even developed, just to see whether you should go in, like, and by the way, I don't recommend doing this. I think you should really go and explore an idea to the limits before you present it. But you know, and also sometimes it's just the rhythm that we have. Like, there's always a show, you know. So it's like you do this, and then the next day you have another show, and all of this shows I've produced in a discipline of we always need to produce stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so
the routine.
Exactly. And so, you know, so you need to have something by 8 p.m. tonight.
Mm.
So it's not going to be amazing. And then it's so you try it out and it's usually half baked. And then most of the time the audience will kill it on the spot or the audience or you, you know, because you say it in front of other people and then you're like, I don't know why I say this. Like, it doesn't feel right saying that. Sometimes the audience doesn't laugh, but you still feel like, yeah, but you know what? I enjoy that, or I think it's an important idea or whatever. Yeah. And you give it a bit more chance. Or the audience laughs, and then all of a sudden, you get a lot more fun with this idea. So some people are able to have fun on their own. I need kind of like the validation of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the online comedy has been so hard, is that it's the first time that I have to go 100% on only my instincts.
Yeah.
And actually, the shows where we've had more fun is when we had, you know, we started to have like technical help in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy came, and then one show he brought his daughter, and she was helping out. But just to have them too laugh, it just made it so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And because performing for the camera is this lens, and you know, and especially if you have insecurities or like you just dump all of your insecurities on that lens who's like hasn't, you know, done anything.
Yeah.
but you start imagining, you know, what people might think or and I actually believe that, I don't know, I think maybe this is like the one of the goals in comedy is you get yourself to a point where you don't make stories about what other people are thinking what you're on stage. I do that a lot.
Of course.
And I need to, and if they're laughing, then actually it's only when they laugh that I'm able to shut that part of my brain completely.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and I'm my most creative because like then I'm super relaxed and I don't imagine. It's like, yeah, well, obviously they're enjoying themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's also the laughter. It's not open to interpretation.
Yeah.
Well, unless you can get really paranoid and then you're like, well, actually they were mocking me.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's another level.
But how was it for you, the first stage you did, for example?
So the first four ones went really well. So I was 22 and I did this open mic in Boston. And so I signed up. And I had four friends in the audience, and there was one that was laughing super loud. So the first 3 minutes, nobody was laughing except for this guy. So it kind of, his laughter like carried me through the whole set.
Yeah.
And then after 3 minutes, applause break. And I'm like, what the hell? You know, so I came out of it. I was feeling super positive.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did another three shows. I did one for like the international. So I was a student in Boston. I did one for the International Student Association of my school, and it was like 100 people killed. And I did two more that went really well, and I thought, that's it. I'm the next genius of comedy.
Yeah.
And he only took that one thought to ruin it all.
What was it?
No, that, like, you know, just thinking.
To think,
that's it. Yeah, I've got something special. Yeah. And then it was a humility. And then I started to bomb.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, it's amazing how it works.
And then I did it. And then, you know, I came back to France. I did some comedy there for like 3 years and then completely stopped for 12 years.
Why? Because of bombing or?
No, actually, you know, when I look back, I wish I had a bit of a different... The things I know now.
Of course, but...
When it comes to, you know, all I have... What I would have needed is a little bit more... I mean, I had a good work ethics, okay? Mm-hmm. So I was showing up almost every day at my, you know, at my writing, and I was doing things.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember leaving jokes in my, so very after a year and a half, I had my own hour that I would do twice a week in this very small theater in Paris. It was like 30 people. Awesome. And everybody was making fun of me at the time. Today, it's become like one of the cool places in Paris. It's called La Loge Théâtre. And, you know, and you have people like Marina Rollman. She was there for a long, like Alexandre Kominek is also from the Swiss French. He was in that place for quite some time. And like, so now everybody goes through this theater. But at the time, it was... People were like, what are you doing in this place? But I loved it, you know, because I always had, and even if I had only 8 people in the audience, it was so small that it felt like I had a crowd. But I would leave a joke that didn't work well in the show. Like, you know, so a joke that doesn't work well is like, you know, 50% success rate in a joke. Like, that's not good. You know, like, you need a joke that works 9 times out of 10. You know, that's kind of how, because in a way, I think professional comedy, you need to have like a routine that is so bulletproof that you do it everywhere and people laugh, you know, and maybe they don't laugh at every joke the same, but you know, you have something like you need to deal it. In comedy, it's so funny because there's one part that is art, which is like, you know, your view on the world and, and like what we said earlier, like making, you know, finding relief for painful stuff. But at the same time, there's a part that is job, which is you need to have like a certain laugh rate, and like people want their money's worth for when they pay for comedy.
Yeah.
And even today, like where audiences don't pay, when you know there's a lot of shows where people don't pay, like they pay after, like open. They still want to have, because time is precious as well. So even if it's for free, they still they don't want to waste 1 hour of their precious time.
Yeah.
And so there's a part of it that is very, you know, you need to get a job done. And that's what, so Seinfeld was saying that you don't call a plumber thinking that there's a 50% chance that he's going to do his job right.
Yeah.
Okay, you call a plumber because he's going to do his job right.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the same with comedians. Like, comedians are, they're called to make people laugh. And if they don't, then they don't get hired again. So I don't know why we talked about that.
So what did you
wish? Oh, yeah. So what I wish that, you know, so I would leave jokes for 6 months in the show when they didn't have a good enough
percentage
or, you know, or like success rate. And that's crazy. Today, when I think about it, it's crazy. Like, I just, and the reason why I did this is that I've struggled my entire life with issues of like self-perception, self-esteem and everything. And so at the time I was thinking, you know, well, it's me. It's the way I deliver it. I don't know how to act. You know, so I was just like so focused on I don't know how to act.
Yourself.
So maybe if I say it this way. Like, so, you know, so a joke that didn't work, I would try to say it in 25 different ways.
Okay.
And actually today I realized that, I mean, yes, there is a part of delivery.
Yeah.
But there's also a part of the joke. Like, you know, there's the idea. So, of course, delivery is still, I would say, 50% of the... But it's not just that, you know. So I would always think it's, and then, so looking back, I would have said, you know, it's just not that funny, you know. So replace it with another one, and this time around, I've been a lot more ruthless with killing jokes, like just not get attached, and produce a lot. And the reason I think the reason it was different this time is so. So we did our first open mic in Zurich. It's almost 4 years ago now. So 4 years ago, and I almost didn't do it. So I was still trying to be, so, you know, so after the novel that I failed plus the child story, I thought I'm going to be a thriller writer because that's, I like thrillers. So then I went to Bristol because I went for work and there was also this convention called Crime Fest to meet other crime writers. And this guy Jack Roberts has been pushing like a bunch of guys to try to make this comedy open mic happen. And so it was supposed to happen the Sunday when I was flying back from Bristol. And I was just like, you know, I didn't feel like it. Like, I was like, I don't think I'm going to do it. But the thing that I did this time is that I had to prepare 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And actually, I wrote 15 minutes.
Mm, I did that, yeah.
And I killed, you know, 2/3 of it. And it was the first time that I did this. Like, when I was 20, something, if I had to prepare 5 minutes, I would prepare 5 minutes. And then it was really a good lesson for me because I learned, wow, like, it's actually part of work to produce a lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be so focused on, look at the shit that I produced, and then I don't have it. You know, and this is kind of how, this is what I was telling you over, you know, messaging that's kind of got us to this podcast,
mm-hmm.
is that I had a very fixed mindset when it came to comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I had it in general, but
what was it you're gonna share?
So yeah, so you know, a fixed mindset is when you think that people are what they are, and you either have amazing talent in something or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like, and you think that you have a capacity for something, and that's pretty much what you're gonna
do
yeah. your whole life.
Yeah. That our parents' mindset, kind of.
Yeah, I mean,
how we got raised.
Maybe.
Yeah. As French, especially, I feel like.
Well, French, it's even worse. I think the French system teaches us that we're shit. Because, I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, in France, just even the grade system, you're happy if you have 12 out of 20. You know, it's like, or at least I was, you know. Like,
I had that, yeah.
It's like, I have 12 out of 20. I was like, good. And excellence was 15 out of 20, you know, or 16 out of 20.
Yeah.
At least, I don't know, in the places where I went.
What did you do? What kind of back?
I did a scientific back.
No, that's why. It was tough. No?
Yeah. Well, it was more, I mean, no, I was good with scientific. So in those, I actually got really good grades. but I just remember, I mean, for me, this whole system set me up for mediocrity, for always, you know, beating yourself up for not being good enough.
Mm. What did you do afterwards? Still scientific?
So no, so I went to prepa. I went to the prepa for business school.
There's a prepa for a business school.
Yeah,
I didn't know.
You know, for HEC, ESSEC, etc.
Ah, okay.
And I got into ESSEC, but then I decided to do a film school in Boston. So it was a bit of a drama with the family, mm-hmm. and everything. But I also needed to get out. Like, I just needed to go far away from everything. So the first time around, I had this fixed mindset, and I thought, you know, so every time I was in front of my, you know, of my writing, if what I write is shit, then I'm like, well, this is it. I'm shit. You know? So, like, why? And it's so much mental energy. I still have it, but at least I can talk myself into continuing, or just being like, okay, like, or as a different part of me, and be like, yeah, okay, we'll deal with, well, you'll get to talk a little bit later. It still talks a lot,
mm-hmm.
but at least it doesn't stop me, but it used to stop me.
Yeah.
So very fixed, you know, you have it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, so, and then, yeah, this time around, I realized, okay, you just have to, the job is to produce a lot, mm-hmm. and then pick, you know, pick the best, and then, you know, show it in front of an audience, and then weed out again more stuff. But producing a lot is part of the, it's part of it. And so I just wish that I, you know, that I didn't beat myself up so much for, you know, all the failed writing sessions,
mm-hmm.
and what, you know, a failed...
Because it failed from your perspective.
Yeah, exactly. But for me, a failed writing session is you know, no inspiration.
Mm. Oh, I love this topic. Yeah. Yeah.
And so... So I'm not able to explain you inspiration. I don't know where it comes from. I just know that it happens sometimes.
And when and how? Do you know what kind of environment, mindset you're in when it happens?
No, so I don't have a magic recipe. The only thing that I know is that by getting in front of, you know, my writing every day, it shows up sometimes, mm-hmm. you know? So inspiration is there, and then, but yeah, I mean, what helps is of course to be in silence. Like I need to be on my own, isolated from people. I can't be in the same room with anybody, even if they're quiet or something. Mm. I need to be in my own room. Mm. Like I need to feel that I'm doing my thing.
Mm.
So whenever I'm with somebody else, I can't write.
It's interesting
because I feel like they're watching or something. Mm-hmm. Like it, even though the crazy part is, yeah, at some point it's gonna be watched by somebody, but in this moment, I need to be on my own.
Yeah.
And showing up. For me, the morning works better.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it, really. But then you know, so I used to make inspiration my goal. And this is kind of, you know, what I wanted to share about creativity, or at least my process, is that if I make inspiration my goal, I make myself miserable.
Mm-hmm.
My only goals right now is to just show up, and I put, you know, a certain number of words that I have to write.
Yeah.
Or I say write for 30 minutes. But then the trick is, because if you say 30 minutes and then you just look up for 25
and
minutes.
And your phone. And, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's...
Doesn't
so
work.
It's better to say like a certain number of words,
yeah.
because then you have to do that.
Yeah.
And most of the time it's terrible. Like, and it's not very different from this podcast. Like, no. What I mean is that a lot of the time it's me doing my own therapy.
Yeah.
So,
and that's not very different.
Yeah, yeah, so that's what I meant. that's what I meant, Ophelia. <Yeah.
laughs>
So, you know, so I found I'm a lot more creative when I don't have the pressure, you know, so when I don't have a pressure of success from that I'm expecting from other people. You know, so actually the only creative goal that I have is to write 450 words a day. That's my only goal.
Mm-hmm. And which is what, for comedy or for anything?
So I focus on comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be for anything. If I would decide now today to write a story or something else, I would say, you know, then, you know, write 450 words
yeah.
a day on this story. If I didn't have a full-time job, it would be much more. But I found, and 450, I believe, is not enough. However, or it's not enough. Actually, it's been enough for me to produce a lot of stuff, but...
Is it 5 minutes set, or what is it?
Yeah, like, for me, I'm around 100 words per minute.
Okay.
But it changes if I do it in English or in French. Mm. In French,
yeah.
It's a bit more. It's like 120.
There are more words.
Yeah.
In
French. And so... So that works for me. So really not setting, as soon as I start thinking, and this is also one of the things that I would put so much pressure on my creativity. You know,
mm-hmm.
I was 20 and I felt, you know, I need to prove myself to the world and I need to have, you know, I want to have this big show and tour and have all of this success and my creativity doesn't do well under the pressure of success. Like,
yeah.
It's so funny, when I met Vanessa, 2 years ago, she was like, what are your goals? I'm like, leave me alone. I don't want any goals. Like, because this, what has kept me going, and actually, I've achieved a lot more this time around than back in the
without
days.
Without goals?
Without any goal.
That's great.
Because yeah. I've let it grow organically. Yeah. I think at some point, I mean, but yes, at some point when you have so many minutes of material, you know, you can say, okay, then my next goal is to do like my 50-minute show.
Mm-hmm.
Or
and you already had one.
I did one. So. I did one.
In Paris.
Oh yeah, no, but I wanted to do another one. So I did one for my 40th birthday.
Okay.
And it was I was again too stressed. Like I put so it was okay, but I was kind of disappointed when I left the stage. But it's okay. So now I have a growth mindset. So it's okay.
Yeah, let's talk about this.
So the growth mindset is believing that you can. I have very unstructured thoughts, as you can tell. So I hope whoever is listening, your listeners, are still following, because I take a lot of tangents. So growth mindset is to believe that, you know, you have certain ability at this point,
mm-hmm.
but you can get better abilities and you can become better at what you do, etc., etc. And so it's not because you had a failed writing session or you had a failed show that it means that
it's over,
that you cannot become better at it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really, you know, a lot of, so people who are in the growth mindset, they actually have a better understanding of their own abilities. And they're better to, you know, able to grow. And in the end, they achieve, they also achieve quite a lot. You know, mm-hmm. people who from the beginning, we thought, okay, these people don't really have an ability for this.
Do you think it's related to no fucks given? Like,
no, if, what? No.
Like, fucks, like, if I fail, doesn't matter. If,
So I would love to not give a fuck.
Yeah.
It's still painful, okay? So even when I have a failed writing session, which is most days, I don't get inspiration. I don't have one joke. It still hurts. But I just know that I just don't let it become, you know, this, well, you know, you're not Seinfeld.
Overtake.
So, you know, you're not Seinfeld, so why don't you give up? And in a way, I kind of gave up at 20. So a couple of things happened. I met a woman, so and I moved to the UK from Paris. So I was in the UK, and then you know, I didn't have any new material.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, I was also freaked out because I saw this comedian who was, you know, kind of who I thought he was really funny. And he had been in comedy maybe like 10 years, and he was with Jean Dujardin for mm-hmm. quite some time. But Jean Dujardin had made it big, and he was mm-hmm. still playing in the same theaters as mm-hmm. me. And I thought he was super funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, wow, like this is such a tough world, mm-hmm. you know. But I don't know. Today, also, I would say, you know, it doesn't matter. Like it's, you know, just keep doing funny mm-hmm. stuff. Like also today, I pursue funny for funny's sake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I'm really.
Because you like it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to have, you know, yeah, maybe the second goal I have is that I want to have 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes that work really well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's kind of like, it's a pursuit of that, but it's not a pursuit of financial goals or, mm-hmm. or you know, or I should have my Netflix show mm-hmm. or you know, I want to have I don't know, or make so much money from my shows or whatever. Maybe I should, maybe it's my mistake, I don't know.
But you just said that when you didn't have goals it worked better than
for me at least. Yeah, for at least when I create for creativity
mm-hmm.
I need to really, it only works when I free myself from, you know, from the imagining the future or the success
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm.
So yeah, inspiration is kind of a you know,
a bitch.
Yeah, like the French way, you know, it's a bitch.
No, but Stephen Pressfield. So my point of view about that, yeah. And I mean, I read the book, but I really like his idea that it kind of comes to you, for you, and then through you, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And it's not you who creates it. I really like that idea, and I shared it in one of my blog posts.
Yeah.
That it's this divine thing, you know? And that kind of thinking can make you so much more relaxed about whatever's coming through you, because then it's not you, and then when it's not coming, it's okay, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. So, I mean, it's still disappointing.
It's still painful.
It's still disappointing. But you're right. Like, it seems to come out of this place with, I believe it comes from a part of you that is not accessible through your... But so you might as well think it's like a deity or something divine, because anyway, it's so out of your control. Even if it comes from your own subconscious, you can't access it consciously. You know, so in a way, yes, it does come through you, but it does have this element of divine, or because it's very mysterious. But even, you know, and then so that's inspiration when writing, but there's also inspiration when performing, and that is also. I cannot say when it, you know, happens or not. And so that's one of the reasons why I was a bit disappointed by my 40th show, is that I wasn't very inspired on stage.
Because you were stressed.
Yeah. And so it's like, imagine 50 minutes not being very inspired.
But what is inspired is the ability to freestyle, or what is it?
No, more... Because actually... As a performer, you still have to make decisions on when you make your pauses, what intonations, what your movements and everything. And sometimes I'm on stage and I just see clearly what I need to do next and how I should say it. And maybe now I need to talk like that. Or now I mean that, you know, you see what I mean? Like, do your changes.
Yeah.
But it's so funny. It's like, it's through me.
Yeah.
It's like somebody's, or I don't know, something is telling me what I need to do next.
Yeah.
But there are some times I have no clue, you know? Yeah. So I'm just there and I kind of feel.
So you want to feel in the zone, you know? You want to be, we call it, so I have a yoga teacher background. So yeah, maybe I didn't share that. Channeling.
Channel my muse.
But then it's exactly this thing that you just described of sometimes I had it teaching yoga, you know, like some words come out of you, but you have no idea why you just said that. You didn't plan to say it, and you won't remember it after either.
Exactly. Yeah. And I find that the best way to channel... is to show up, actually. So, you know, so showing up in front of my page and showing up on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I also push myself. See, the one thing that I push myself to do is to get up on stage.
Because that's still hard?
No, but try to do as many shows as possible.
Just time.
No,
time
but it's wise, it's more. It's easier to not go on stage because there's you always have excuses and stuff. You know, I have children.
That's a good excuse. Like,
drop the excuse, please.
Thank you to your wife right now.
Yeah, she's fine. She's good.
She's good. Does she come see you sometimes?
Yes, she comes to see me. It's actually important to have a supportive spouse.
Yeah.
Because if she wasn't, then, I mean, I'd be divorced right now. Or I would have had to make a choice.
Yeah.
Her or comedy, because it's...
time-consuming.
It's very time-consuming. You're away a lot.
Yeah.
Does
she laugh at your jokes?
Yeah. I have a lot of jokes about her as well.
Yeah, I heard one in French. I can't remember, that she's from, that you got her from Ukraine and
Ukrainianwives.com. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, she thinks it's funny.
Okay. So support.
I didn't meet her. We were colleagues. That's how we met each other. I didn't buy her on the internet.
I'm glad we clarified that.
But I think it's a stereotype, and now, like, it's also because I think the joke works because, so first, now with being 40, I look older, and also, like, I put on weight, and, like, and people think, yeah, he could have bought his wife on the internet. So that's why it works.
And where was it? In Zurich?
Yeah. So she works here as well. So we're in my office as well. Oh, in my office. We're in the office of my employer.
We're using it. It was even hard to get in, huh? But I even wanted to say we're doing a podcast, but you were like, no.
Don't say anything. It's better.
Yeah. So, inspiration, creativity, the growth mindset that says that you can, basically, you can do anything you want, or...
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't mean that it's easy, or mm-hmm. that, but...
You have to put the work
and,
into
and
it.
And you also need a focus, right? So, mm-hmm. if... I've been really focused on the stand-up,
mm-hmm.
and that's how, like, I've become better at it
mm-hmm.
In the past 3 years, because I was... But... So you definitely need focus, but I think the growth mindset has also helped me to think, okay, for my current job, I've had to like switch 40 schools online, you know, so everything that we're doing, you know, teaching languages to, mm-hmm. to people, we had to switch to online.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, if I can switch 40 language schools online, I can switch a comedy show
mm-hmm.
online.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that I had no idea how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I'm putting a date. It's going to be in 20, like, it's not even, it was between, like, I don't know, 18 days, whatever. And we have to do this comedy show.
Mm-hmm.
And the growth mindset has also helped me to be like, okay, it's probably not going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but just go for it. Like, try to put together a concept, mm-hmm. do it. And see what happens. And then, you know, so... And then from every episode, we learn. And I've left... So we're doing this live. You know, it's a live broadcast. And for many weeks, you know, like, we would go off air. And I would just have this cringing feeling about, like, what we just did. And it was terrible. And in a way, that pain is difficult because...
Yeah.
You've gotten good at stand-up. You don't want to go back to the bombing that mm-hmm. you were doing 3 years mm-hmm. before. And so... But I was like, okay, well, growth mindset, right? So it's not gonna be good, but let's see what we can learn. How can we make it better? And then, you know, and it's becoming more and more pleasurable. Like
mm-hmm.
The last one, we stopped streaming, and I was like, wow, this was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this was a really cool show.
Mm-hmm.
And it still has a lot to improve, you know? But, because when you're in a fixed mindset, you're always, that's what people with fixed mindset, they tend to be a bit aggressive as well, because for them, it's terrible. If they are proven that they are not... It's either they're really good at something or they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So they're also trying to prove everybody else that they are very good, you know, because
mm-hmm.
they cannot, if they are under the line of whatever that they've set for themselves,
mm-hmm.
then it means their own reality. It means, well, I guess, you know, I'm not good at that. So
mm-hmm.
they're very defensive, very, and it's not a, I really recommend actually to read this book that I,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I forgot the title.
I can add it in the text.
It's, I have it somewhere.
I have it on my computer.
I think I have it in our conversation anyway. But,
yeah, And you said something interesting. Did you find it?
No.
When, and if you don't want me to share, I can cut it. But
sure.
You said, yeah, right. Because I asked you what's the difference between doing it live and behind your screen. And
yeah.
You said, well, yeah, of course it's not the same, but this growth mindset thing. And right now there are a lot of people trying out things online, and so they're forgiving if it's not perfect.
Yeah, so it's really, I mean, right now is the best time to put out shitty content. Because because
yeah.
People get it, you know, so... I mean, actually, you know, if I wanted to say, okay, now this is my goal, I want to get into live broadcast, you know, weekly live broadcast, put on a show, then it's fine. I could have also done it outside of this pandemic situation.
Yeah.
But at least right now I feel people are, you get a bit more forgiveness from the audience. But even if you're listening to this in the future and it's not a pandemic, I also believe you should still, you know, go ahead if you want to do it and improve. But I would say that now is even a better time. Because every comic has gone online doing Zoom shows or talk shows, or, and it's tough. It's really tough. People are used to interacting with people, getting feedback, you know, making people laugh in front in front of you, and kind of everybody's trying to figure it out. But it is possible, because, you know, there are people who are funny in front of the camera even without an audience.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, like.
This young generation who started on YouTube, no?
So, yes, so there are a lot of YouTubers who know how to be funny. But even before, you know, like in traditional TV, somebody like Ricky Gervais, who did a show like The Office, there was no audience, you know? It was not like a sitcom in the sense that there was kind of like the jokes were tested in front of an audience. It was... It was just them, just really believing in their in their comedy. So that's kind of, you know, yeah, it's kind of, it's an interesting period that pushes me to really get behind my own comedy.
Like, upgrade, or what do you mean?
So
step up
before,
or?
Yeah, I mean, in the traditional process that we go through, it's like, okay, so I would test joke in like 1-2 open mic, 3 open mics, and usually I'd be sitting, you know, at a desk not close to here, and it's 4 p.m. and I'm like, I have a mic in 3 hours, you know. So then I looked at like everything that I have written in my morning session, and I put something together, and it's kind of like halfway done. And then the joke improves with the, you know, with the audience. But this time I have to work on the joke,
so prepare more.
Prepare more, and also, but believe in it more, because I get one chance. And, you know, my belief in the joke before came mostly from the audience. I mean, there must be some beliefs in the first place if I say it in front of somebody. But then a lot had to come from, you know, a lot of the belief came from the interaction, whereas now it just comes from, well, I mean, it's not just me, actually, because we do the jokes to each other.
Okay.
We're like, you know, we're like four people working on this, and we read. So there's still some bouncing off of ideas, but it's not the same.
And how do you decide to make it a joke? When you see something and you find something funny, how does this work?
So what I do is, so I do two things, right? So every morning I do my, you know, X number of words.
Yeah.
But I also, every time I have an idea, I just put it in a, so some people have notebooks, I just send myself an email. Okay. So, and then, so, you know, so, and then, but I usually I have this idea, but I'm in the middle of a meeting or something, so I can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
So then what I do is that in my morning sessions, I would go through my ideas that I sent to myself and see, like, are there some that still inspire me?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I do it. It's not very scientific.
Mm-hmm. So you just write a couple of words.
Yeah, I just wrote a line.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you can go into the situation again.
Yeah, and if I'm not, then, you know, it tells me that maybe it wasn't that funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought on the moment it's funny, mm-hmm. but if one day later I get no emotion out of it, then fine, you know, mm-hmm. like then maybe it's just not worth putting it in front of audience and, you know.
Do you laugh when you write?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully, when I put... I mean, it's me laughing is kind of, yeah, it's kind of like one of the, I would say, criteria for a joke to go on stage, right? Because mm-hmm. otherwise, what's the mm-hmm. point?
Oh, but I was, for me too, but I was listening to a podcast. It's Un Café au Lucet from Louis Dubourg, French comedian.
Yeah.
And he interviewed many French comedians.
Okay, famous, oh, that's interesting.
Marina Rollman, also a couple of Swiss, Thomas Wiesel. And,
yeah.
And I was listening to that. It was really a nice podcast. And he was asking that, I think, to Marina Rollman. And she hesitated. And they both hesitated. And I was like, fuck yeah, I laugh. You know? But maybe then there are people who kind of think of a joke as a market research, you know, like what would people laugh or to this or, you know, but I feel I do everything that it comes from myself, you know. I don't care, and that's why I'm not making money yet with the podcast. But yeah,
I guess, you know what, okay, I don't always laugh all the time, but I am excited about saying that to other people. Like I try to really only say things on stage that got me emotionally excited somehow, when I wrote it mm-hmm. or when I think about doing it on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's kind of the criteria.
And you share mostly private life things, or you share?
Yeah, mostly private stuff.
No political.
No.
Point of view.
No, you know what? I'm very interested in politics, but I don't feel strongly about anything. Yeah. Usually political comedians, they tend to really defend a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's left-wing. Like, I've tried to watch some right-wing comedians, but it's just, I don't know. Just
weird.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Because also comedy, what we're saying earlier is that, you know, it's what is allowed to make fun of the powerful.
Mm.
But usually, you know, in politics, the right-wing point of view is more the point of view of the powerful. And so I just find that it doesn't really work.
What's
with comedy.
Point? Yeah.
But they exist.
Mm. Who is doing this? A famous...
You know what? Famous? No, nobody famous. Mm. But, you know,
no.
The display, like Fox News or like even RT, they have conservative comedians.
Okay. Good to know. We won't watch that. No. I had something totally different in mind. First time I do this, because I had the dream this week. And
there you go. Let's do it.
I thought as I woke up, I thought I have to remember that.
Okay.
And in my dream, I don't know if we were doing this podcast or if we were what I was, or comedy, or I don't know what I was doing, but so a word came into mind, and it's Swiss as fuck. Swiss AF.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And I wondered if you had a couple of things to say about that, like examples of your own life. Because I know you, for example, you said that joke about if you want to have fun or something exciting happening on Sunday morning in your life, just start the washing machine, and yeah, all the neighbors will be in your living room.
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, I mean, Swiss has... so that's one. I think for me, I have a joke also, but maybe, I don't know if you heard that one, where I picked up my kids from the daycare.
No.
And I asked them...
And they go to the normal...
Yeah, so they went to the Swiss German daycare. I mean, now they go to school, but before, mm-hmm. you know, we put them in the daycare a few days a week for them to learn Swiss German, mm-hmm. and stuff. And you know, and you have to, so you pick them up and you have to listen to, like, for them it's really important.
They
tell
game.
You what happened for them.
Yeah.
But then the only thing that they just tell, the most boring thing in the world, you know, so it's like, so, you know, Alexi was very good.
He ate his peas, ate
the
but
green
not
beans,
the...
and then he had the rice. And then, so in my joke, I say, but okay, but and for me as a parent, it's more like I want to know how they're developing, you know, like, are they socially good?
Did,
like,
they
how
hit
do they...
anybody?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So in my joke, I say, okay, but tell me about the other, like, how is he interacting with the other children? And she says, well, the other children, they also had the green beans. And for me, this is Swiss as fuck. Because, and like, and even for my Swiss friends, like, they say this is so Swiss. Because it's, but I mean, it's so stereotypically Swiss, you know, like the total lack of creativity. And being asked a question that doesn't, you know, that doesn't
follow
yeah. the process, and being confused and like, what is he asking the other children? Yeah, and but it just says it so much in like in one line. And this joke is what is one of my killer jokes, and it works in every language that I've tried it.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty Swiss as fuck.
That's pretty Swiss.
Yeah.
And your kids speak Swiss German?
Yeah, yeah. They are. I mean, they Swiss German, French, and Russian.
And they have an accent when they speak French to you?
No.
Or you don't know this?
No, they don't really have an accent, but they are. I mean, poor kids. It's for them. It's very confusing to have all these languages, right? So they always mix.
Hmm.
They mix, for example, the order of words.
Mm.
You know, like sometimes they speak French to me. I'm like, yeah, you're thinking in German.
Yeah.
They put the verb at the end or stuff like that. Or, you know, how they put the adjectives.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, they have an interesting way to, like, if we would go to France, the kids would say they talk funny.
Yeah.
Because they have a, but it's not so, yeah, so it's not so much the accent, or, you know, they say stuff like, for many years, to say something like, something is difficult, my son, instead of saying c'est difficile, would say c'est lourd, because in German, schwer can be, you know, so, so they make this weird mistakes, but they, I mean, they'll be all right, it just takes a bit longer.
Yeah.
But definitely harder for them to integrate with other kids for quite some time.
Mm.
Now they're okay, but, you know, because the other kids, they speak Swiss German with their parents all the time. I mean, and it's so they've definitely felt behind. Even the small one who's gonna be 5. But even, you know, the 7-year-old, he still doesn't understand everything that people are telling him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a long process.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
I think they're gonna be alright. I hope.
And now they go to normal school, Swiss.
Yeah,
German
Swiss
school.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for me, it's interesting to know.
Yeah, I kind of felt that we were here for the long run, and then I thought, okay. When I moved to Zurich, I found like a home in a way. So I was traveling a lot for work.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually even traveling more than now. So I was traveling maybe 75% of my time, and so I would spend my weekend in Zurich, and this was my, you know, this is where I would rest and I would kind of relax, and it was my home. And I mean, it was nice. So I have this relationship with Zurich that, like, I feel really good here. And then when we had kids, I could see myself staying here. Mm. And then I thought, so for them, it's very important mm-hmm. that they are, you know, because I see, I mean, the kids in the international schools, it's not the same. Like, I mean, some of them don't speak German even. Mm-hmm.
It's their own world.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's their own world. Mm. So, yeah, so we put them in public schools.
Mm. A lot of people do that, actually. I'm with a lot of expats, parents in Basel, and they do that. And you, like us, you know, we don't speak Swiss German. I can a little bit because I grew up across the border, but...
Uh-huh, you grew up in Saint-Louis, or...?
Inang.
Inang, okay.
Yeah, and my grandparents speak...
Alsacian,
and it's like Swiss German.
Yeah, almost, yeah, it's the know? Same, yeah, almost.
So, I understand everything, and I can speak certain sentences, but I could not have a whole conversation in Swiss German, and that sometimes creates a little gap. Yeah. Especially at work. Maybe here it's more international, I don't know, at your work.
Oh, my work, it's in English.
Mm. At mine, it's getting there, but still it's very traditional and, yeah.
Right.
Swiss as fuck.
Swiss as fuck.
And what was the thing that shocked you the most in Switzerland? The difference? Anything? I have this joke about garbage, for example, the blue, I don't know which color it is here, but this thing you have to ask for at the supermarket that you cannot just find on the shelves.
Yeah.
Because it's the tax system.
Yeah.
That was like, what?
That didn't shock me because I walked into Switzerland with the fear of the rules. And so, like, I kind of knew, like, so nothing surprised me.
Okay.
In a way, maybe I found some peace in that.
Really? Yeah, that's interesting.
So,
did you come from Paris?
Yeah, I come from Paris. I have to actually, you know, I mean, the jokes and the stereotypes about the Swiss is, you know, it's all about the rules and lack of, you know, creativity. But, you know, when you actually get interested into Swiss culture or the actual facts and everything. So, you know, so for example, we say, yeah, they're very closed and, you know, yeah, but I mean, maybe, but the percentage of immigrants in this country is a lot higher than many other countries. Mm-hmm. Like, and this society that has a reputation for being closed is actually, when you look at the facts, is very open. And they assimilate a lot of people, you know, like there's more, the percentage of immigrants here is higher than its neighboring countries. Mm-hmm. And
and it's way to deal with the coronavirus pretty okay also.
Yeah, I thought it was, I mean, I was, honestly, when I was seeing my friends in France who cannot go out only 1 hour a day, I mean, thank God we were here. And able to go, you know, to the forest with the kids. And, I mean, it changed completely everything. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of... I got interested in... So in October, I'm going to start the process to be naturalized Swiss. So last year, I started to learn about the history and everything. Okay. And I was like, I wish I had done this when I arrived. Because when you come from France... And especially from Paris, you know, because at least when you're not in Paris, you know that this dream that Paris controls everything. But I mean, in a way, it's France is very centralized, and we still have, I mean, the president figure is almost still like a king figure in a way, you know, so it's centralized around a king figure in Paris. And expecting a lot of, you know, and making decisions for everybody. And if you're in the opposition, you know, then you have to suck it up for 5 years because it's not. Whereas here is very different, and there's not so much this, you know, this idea of a nation, you know, they don't really buy in it so much. I mean, yes, they have some Swiss pride, but it's still very regional. I mean, even like the different dialects of Swiss German, everybody's still very attached to, you know, like what we speak in my valley is a different language than your valley. And so very decentralized. And also, I mean, So all these members of government that we saw in the press conferences for the updates on the coronavirus, like for me, I was really proud before because I was like, so I had to learn them, you know. So like in December they were elected, and I was like, okay, so when I'm gonna do my process, they're gonna be in power, so I need to. Mm-hmm. So I learned all the names and everything, but now it feels like it's not, because everybody knows them almost. So I feel less special. But, you know, if you look at, so you look at the government of the Confederation, they are from they're from four different parties, you know, which is like inconceivable in France. In France, you have the party in power and they decide everything. Whereas the, you know, so it's four different parties that have to like talk and negotiate with each other. And it's very not French. And that I find really interesting, you know. So this is kind of what surprised me. It's a more flexible and open society than people want to believe, just from the attitude, or everybody has the anecdote of like, you know, the neighbors that yells at you for not following the rules and everything. But if you look a bit deeper into the actual facts, and that's what surprised me. It's more open and flexible than people think, because they had to.
It is, but the neighbor yelling at you, it's still true.
Yeah.
It's still happening.
Yeah.
Or the fine for everything, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I also feel when I'm here, I'm like, okay, I have to, you know, cycle here and not there, because somebody will tell you, don't do this.
Yeah.
Old person.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I... There's both, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I absolutely, and that's still annoying.
Still, for a French, like, you know.
Yeah, for a French, exactly. We don't like the rules.
No, and nobody. You would never say, "Hey, don't do that," because
yeah, exactly.
Can't.
Yeah,
and we don't care.
Yeah, you would be seen as a collabo or whatever.
But that's also why they made it so strict in France then during the coronavirus period, because they knew the French. If you look at the also Spain and Italy, I don't know how it happened in Italy, but in Spain and Greece also was really strict. I have a friend living in Greece, and she said, yeah, they had to do this, fine you 150 euro if you, I don't know, don't have the paper or whatever, because the Greek don't believe in the government. And she has, as a Swiss there, she's like, no, I'm still going to the beach. But yeah, it was interesting, I think.
That's true.
Because here, I didn't see my Swiss friends, you know? They were like, no, see you one day again.
Yeah.
And then when I was like, okay, let's meet, cafes are reopening, they were like, really? Yeah, sure. We'll stay outside. It's okay.
Yeah, people, I mean, German, Swiss, you know, Swedes, like the more you go, there's more a culture of discipline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, France, Italy, Spain, we like Latin. To be undisciplined.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. I'm very happy to live here.
I like it here.
Yeah.
Now that's what I mean. So yeah, I just want, like, behind the Swiss neighbor yelling at you, there's more, you know, I think there's a deeper truth.
Yeah.
Of, yes, there's all of this. And also, you know, I've lived in many different countries, and no country is perfect. Like, you will not find, including, and it's going to be hard for us to hear that, but including France.
Oh, for me, it's not hard, actually. I'm French only for the food, I think. The food and the complaints. No, complaints, I'm working on myself, so not so much, but for the swearing. Swearing and food.
Yeah.
Then I'm French. Because I also lived in other countries, then I picked
things. The best of everything. Yeah.
And where can we find you online?
So you can find me in many different places. Sorry, ask the question again.
Fine.
So you can find me
online. Yeah, I guess now online.
Yeah. Ben Comedian. That's my handle on most platforms. Mm-hmm. On the Twitter, Instagram, Facebook.
Mm-hmm. You have a website?
Yes. No, not really.
Okay. And YouTube, where the shows are.
So yeah, and then on it. So you can go to. Okay, I'm a terrible selling myself.
Self-promoter.
Okay, so let me try. So you can find me on Facebook and Instagram. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Ben Comedian. And you can also find me, you can find the online show on Instagram and also Facebook. Mm-hmm. It's online.comedyshow. Online.comedyshow.
And it happens
every Thursday at 8:30 p.m. We're going to have to change it when we do live shows again, because Thursdays is usually my date for my show at Comedy House. Mm-hmm. It's not every Thursday, but it's always on a Thursday. So we'll need to...
Do you know when it's going to start again?
We will have some announcements on the 27th, and then we're hoping in June. Mm-hmm. But let's see.
Wow. Cool.
Cool. Well, thank you for having me, Ophelie.
Thank you for welcoming me into your...
to my deserted office.
Second job. And yeah, hope to see you soon.
Yeah, see you soon.
In real life.
Yes. Let's share the stage in Basel again.
Yes. Thank you for listening.